Hey, out there in Radio Land, welcome to Spectrum West, final program of January. We've had five of them this month. Wow. Time is flying by, and thankfully winter is too. First, the big news for the arts and culture of West Wisconsin is the designation by state government to provide up to $15 million in matching state funds for the proposed Confluence Center within the 2015-2017 state budget. The announcement came from Governor Walker during the Chippewa Valley rally in Madison yesterday. Spectrum West has provided coverage of the proposed center from the first announcement of intentions through debate, the referendum, and will continue to deliver voices of the people and the realization of milestones along the way. Congratulations to everyone working hard to make the new Arts Center and its campus a reality. If you want to hear more about yesterday's announcement, you can go to WPR.org/Eau Claire. Our good friend Rich Kramer has the complete story there. Coming up on today's program, we'll chat with Jason Collins. He's leader of the septet that bears his name. A bit of history and a preview of an upcoming February appearance in Menominee. We'll introduce you to comedian Kent Rader. He, too, is coming to Menominee next month to entertain in a fundraiser for the Red Cedar Youth Stage. Jim Oliver gets the Eau Claire Children's Theater scoop from director Wayne Merrick. And let's inaugurate this edition of Spectrum West right here. It's the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. Yes, America has such a federation, but it bears explanation because we're different than many other countries in how we stack our priorities. I called a gentleman named Adam Horowitz on a snowy day in New York this week to find out just a bit more. Tell us what you are and where you came from, would you please?
Sure. Sadly, we are not a government agency. This is one of the countries in the world that doesn't, in fact, have a cabinet-level position for arts and culture. And we thought that was a bit of an oversight. Sure, we have the National Endowment for the Arts, and that's wonderful and important and does fund a lot. However, not to have something at that larger policy level is kind of an omission. So we decided we're a group of artists across the country working in different media and decided to create the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture as a kind of artwork itself, as a performance of the department that we don't have.
So are you, by forming this, hoping others take notice and maybe something official does eventually crop up?
You know, a lot of what we're doing now, it's really locally oriented. It's an action network, first and foremost. You know, this is not a direct advocacy campaign to create a department, mm-hmm. but we are trying to embody what the projects and what the policies might be that such a department would have. So, you know, the first project that we did was this past summer, and it was a series of imagining. We had 18 cultural agents in different cities across the country hosting these large-scale arts-infused civic dialogues in their communities to imagine the year 2034 when mission has been accomplished for our people-powered department. What does that look like in your community? So what's beautiful about this is it manifests very differently in different places.
What's the parameters of putting together this somewhat national network? I mean, obviously, with social media, things are not as tough as they used to be, but right. How did you physically put this all together?
Well, it started with a seal, a set of words, a statement of values on our site at usdac.us, and with a press conference. So we launched it in October 2013 with a press conference. And that did pick up some media, actually. We were immediately attacked by Glenn Beck, which was surprising.
What could he possibly say negative? Come on.
And he knew we weren't a federal agency. But, you know, this idea of art at the core of our society and its power as a change-making tool and as a connecting tool may have been a little bit threatening. So anyways, yeah, it got out kind of online, and we put out a call for cultural agents. We were astounded by how many folks signed up, said, yeah, I'm ready to volunteer and perform the department with you. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm already doing the work locally, but it's fun to step it up and do it in the context of a larger network.
Uh-huh. The people who were involved in last summer's imaginings phenomenon that you talked about, they were called cultural agents. That's kind of mm-hmm. cool, yeah.
Yeah, one of the phrases that we like to say at the department, this is not an outside agency coming in, this is our inside agency coming out. cultural agents are folks who are already engaged in kind of community-based art in their community and went through a 3.5-month training. We were all online. Imagine kind of Brady Bunch looking on the online web conference thing, gearing up for these imaginings, sharing skills, facilitation tactics. How do we really bring a diverse cross-section of the community into the room together to have a kind of conversation that might not happen in the town hall or city council?
Sure.
And really using art to animate the conversation.
We're on the phone with Adam Horowitz. He is chief instigator of the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, which, by the way, and you can comment on this, Adam, has a declaration that begins in familiar fashion. It starts, "We hold these truths to be self-evident."
It's true. We do. Our statement of values includes ideas that, you know, as the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, culture is a human right. That's kind of front and foremost. We also believe that culture is created by everyone and that cultural diversity is a social good. So we're really looking to animate projects and policies that embody those values. A lot of folks have the connotation with arts with a capital A, and we're okay also with a lowercase a and a broader sense of what culture is and that we are all creators of culture.
We recently watched and listened to the president's State of the Union address. You had or do have a people's State of the Union. In fact, you have something that's going on right now. Story circles?
Exactly. So we saw this opportunity, right? Once a year, the president gives a speech. Well, isn't that a great moment for all of us to come together and to reflect on the state of our union? Isn't democracy a conversation, not just a monologue? So we put out a call inviting folks to host story circles in their communities. Story circles is a very simple form of coming together and sharing stories. But part of the power of it is that it's really a great equalizer. Everyone has 3 minutes to share a story reflecting on the state of our union through their own lived experience. So we did online trainings, and we had about 170 different organizations and individuals sign up to host these story circles across the country. Mm-hmm. That's happening this week. Stories are coming into the online story portal where anyone can contribute the story, even if you're not in one of the circles. And then we have a group of poets lined up who are going to draw inspiration from these stories to compose the poetic address to the nation broadcast on February 1st.
I love the quote, "Democracy is a conversation, not a monologue." Good stuff. Makes sense. And as I alluded, you are the chief instigator. That is on its surface kind of fun sounding, but it leads me to ask if this is serious stuff. Are you committed to all this dogma, or is it simply a satirical way of making a point?
Great question. We don't want to think of it as dogma here. We do call the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture an act of collective imagination.
Okay.
So it really is an invitation to bring your creativity to it, to participate in these actions in a way that makes sense for you. The imaginings all took very different flavors, right? Some were led by poets, others by muralists, others by, you know, many different disciplines. We're both, right? This is a playful endeavor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to trick anyone. This is not a federal agency. But since it doesn't exist, why can't we call ourselves it and kind of enact it? So it has that playful side. And we're also serious about ongoing community impact. So in the places where we held imaginings, it's not just a one-off event. That led to very tangible visions for projects, and there are now field offices continuing to work on those projects, some of which may have a policy orientation, some of which may have a kind of public space or development orientation. So serious play is what we like to say.
You're not expecting some big black SUVs to pull up in front of your place and come to the door and say, "We'd like you to stop doing what you're doing."
Not expecting that. But, you know, if someone tells us we can't use the name anymore, that's part of the story.
Sure. Yeah, and you'll find a different name, I'll bet.
Mm-hmm. You know, one name that we sometimes use, and it's been inspiration for this project, is the idea of a culture corps. The WPA, there was employment for artists working in the public service, and there was some federal money for that in the 70s. Uh-huh. What would it take to get that kind of program off the ground in the 21st century? And we feel like we're building the kind of grassroots groundswell that could build momentum for an initiative like that.
Well, as I said, since this program on a weekly basis deals with the arts and culture and music and humanities in Wisconsin, I'm going to request that you certainly keep us in the loop because we might be a player in helping you get all that stuff off the ground.
We certainly will, yeah. Per the dogma thing, I just want to emphasize our role here is not to say what art is and what art isn't and what culture is and what culture isn't.
I might have pulled the wrong word out of my vocabulary there for dogma. I think my dog was sitting next to me, and maybe it just came to me too quickly. So again, you are chief instigator. You also have a minister of poetry and endangered language protection. What other cabinet members do you have that might have fun names?
Let's see. I know we have a minister of sites of public memory. We have the Minister of Tactical Performance. We've got the Secretary of Cultural Equity, the Minister of Revolutionary Imagination. Ask the People Power Department. You choose your own title. So that's how we end up with this plethora of creativity.
All right. You guys are going about it in the right way. Now, a photo on your website of some outdoor gathering sported a couple of Green Bay Packer chairs being utilized, I saw. Even though budgets for what you represent have been cut here in Wisconsin, we're still hungry for what enriches and entertains us. So how can Wisconsin and people listening to this program become more of a player in the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture? First, people listening can go right to your website. That's a good beginning.
Yep, that's a great beginning at usdac.us. I know those chairs came from the imagining that took place in St. Croix River Valley this past summer.
Okay, cool.
So there may still be some activity there. And now is the time to go to peoplestateoftheunion.usdac.us and share your story. What's your take on the state of our union through something that you've experienced? So even if you can't attend a story circle, this story will be posted online. It's visible to anyone. Mm-hmm. And the poets will take it as inspiration for this poetic address. That's an immediate way to plug in.
Wow.
Meanwhile, you can also enlist as a citizen artist, and we have a big disclaimer, you don't need to be a citizen and you don't need to be an artist. To be a citizen artist with the USDAC, you just have to believe in the power of creativity to make the world better.
Well, everybody listening, I hope, believes in the power of creativity. I know I do. I know you do. Adam Horowitz, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we are going to do what we can to help you spread the word.
Really appreciate that, Alan. Yeah, absolutely. It is a real question of how do we do this in collaboration with existing, you know, public radio infrastructure and some of the great stuff that still does exist.
All right.
Yep.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Take it easy.
Thanks so much.
Again, the website is peoplestateoftheunion.usdac.us. You can share your stories. The general website is usdac.us. The U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, maybe that's the key to effectiveness. Make them sound like a government agency, but don't really be one. Huh? The Jim Oliver Report, comedian Kent Rader, and the music of the Jason Collins Septet coming up on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Home Builders Association. The annual Home and Garden Show comes to the Eau Claire Indoor Sports Center February 21st through 23rd. Ticket information available at cvhomebuilders.com. Jim Oliver, a busy guy himself, what with volunteering here and there most every day, likes to talk with other diligent people. And few theater people are more industrious than Jim's guest this week.
The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Sleeping Beauty, based on the traditional fairy tale, beginning next Thursday and continuing through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Here to talk about the production is Wayne Merrick, who is founder, executive director of the Children's Theater, and director of Sleeping Beauty. Now, I was going to make some snappy comment about whether you sweep out after the shows are over and all that kind of stuff. But then, on my way over here today, I drove past the Children's Theater, the Oxford Theater, on Oxford Avenue, and next to the Chippewa River, and there was Wayne Merrick shoveling off the sidewalk. So I guess, gosh, you do everything.
There's the answer to your snappy question.
I guess so. Well, Sleeping Beauty, the fairy tale, goes all the way back to the 1500s, if not further. But in case somebody hasn't heard the story, do you want to tell us what the story is?
I say, if it's been around that long, I think everybody, you know, by now will have heard of it. But probably every season or two, we try to do what we would call a traditional fairy tale. So a Sleeping Beauty, a Cinderella, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, something like that. It's a great way for young audiences to get exposed to live theater. For many kids, it's their first time with their family to a show. a fairy tale is something that they've heard, they know the story, and then when they see it on stage, they can relate to what's going on. But this is another version of Sleeping Beauty. It's not a Disney version or based on a ballet or anything like that. But the storyline is all the same, where the king and queen of the kingdom are having a baby, and at the celebration for the baby's birth, the evil witch comes to lay her curse, which is that when she turns 16, she will, prick her finger on the spindle of a spinning wheel and die. And the good witches are able to kind of reverse that, of course, so that when that does happen, she will just fall asleep. And like any good fairy tale, of course, the cure to that is the kiss of true love. Mm. And in the meantime, the whole kingdom is put to sleep, too, so that, they don't get all old while she stays young. So the whole kingdom's asleep, and it's up to the prince to, save the day. Defeat the evil witch and, kiss the beautiful princess. And, of course, the last song, is Happily Ever After. So nothing wrong with that once in a while.
Not a bit. How many people in the cast? This sounds like rather a large cast.
Well, that whole story made it sound like it's a larger cast, but it's actually a cast of 19. So kind of on the smaller side for a musical. But it's got, the characters that you would expect to have in it. The all of the good witches. You got always have one bad one. The king and the queen and the court and the prime minister. And, of course, Sleeping Beauty and her prince.
Tell us about the music in the show. Now, that I was going to be smart and talk about the ballet that Tchaikovsky wrote back in 1890, but that has nothing to do with anything. So
not for this one.
What music is involved here?
That's the interesting thing about fairy tales. I've got a small stack of Sleeping Beauty scripts. All of these fairy tales have, numerous adaptations and numerous musical adaptations. So it's somebody's spin on the music. Mm-hmm. This one is pretty eclectic. It does feel a little more not medieval, royal courtish. So a lot of the accompaniment almost sounds harpsichordish. Mm-hmm. But there's also a couple songs that you would consider more jazzy. So it's kind of an eclectic mix of music, not necessarily a certain style or anything like that.
Now, do you have a musical director and a bit of orchestra and all that stuff?
Actually, this is one of those that's done with recorded music. Once again, every season there's maybe one or two of those. There isn't an orchestra or there's no scores for an orchestra. It is meant to be done with recorded music. That's good or bad. There's not the live orchestra, but the cast has been rehearsing with, with that recorded music from day one. So, obviously they're very familiar. It's not like putting it together with the live orchestra at the last minute, which is what usually happens with a larger musical where you join the orchestra the week of tech.
Now, does this have a fairly substantial set?
We are renting a really very nice courtyard backdrop. And there's a couple of castle towers and things like that. So once again, I don't keep saying typical fairy tale, but that's really why it's on this season. There's the five public performances, but then we'll be seeing probably between 1400 and 1500 school children will come through the school matinees on February 6th. And that's another reason why we do these. It's to get the schools in. For many kids, it's their first exposure to live theater. It's great, a great feeder for us, for performers, because a lot of times when we ask them on their audition forms, why are you auditioning or how did you find out? It's because they went to a school matinee. Mm-hmm. They go home and say, I really like that show. I want to do that. And the parents call or check it out. So the school matinees are really a great way for getting people pumped up or excited about being in shows and then also going and seeing other shows. That's a lot of kids to reach with two performances.
Matinees are on Friday?
On Friday the 6th. So we have the five public shows, but then there's two school matinees as well.
He is Wayne Merrick, who is executive director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater and director of the current production of Sleeping Beauty. We need to talk about what's coming up. I looked at your webpage the other day, over the weekend, I guess, and all of a sudden it's full of stuff.
So. It is. We were thinking that February was kind of a down month, but actually that didn't happen this year. we've got a number of special events coming up. February 8th, which is a Sunday, there's the Taste for Theater. It's a wine tasting fundraiser out at From the Vine. Kind of an intimate gathering for up to 40 people with food and wine pairings, music by Kathy Wrights, kind of a casual, relaxed night of fun and fundraising. A couple weeks after that, on February 19th, is our second annual trivia challenge. This year it's Team Jeopardy, based on the Jeopardy game show with questions in that format, electronic game board. We actually even have a welcome recorded by Alex Trebek. So that'll be kind of fun. But that'll be the second year that we've been doing that. So that's a great way just to get your friends together, test your knowledge, have some fun. And that'll be held at the Oxford. And right the next day, we open Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat, which has not been done in the area and is a newer show. It's actually a British import. It's a new show for us and a new show for most groups. Mm-hmm. But once again, a book that everybody knows. So it'll be interesting to see their reaction when it's brought to life on stage. Once again, great show for probably all ages, but obviously the younger audiences. Once again, another great first trip to the theater. It's a shorter show, maybe 40 minutes, and it's a book they've all read, and they probably could recite along with the show, and they'll recognize the thing one and thing two and the cat and the situations. So once again, a great, very physical, very visual show. Props and the sets are designed to look just like the book. Something that the kids will recognize and really enjoy.
So what else is coming?
The next biggie then after that, the following weekend, is Mary Poppins. We're very fortunate to have gotten the rights for that. It was just released last fall. So we took a chance by putting it in the season, and that paid off that the rights came out. That will be a big show. That's got multiple sets and a cast of 30 and a full orchestra and some flying and all the bells and whistles that you might expect being familiar with Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I've always been curious. You run shows, seem like you run shows one right after the other. How do you organize all of that so you can get work rehearsals and performances and all
right.
that?
We've got our annual Murder Mystery Dinner Theater is just wrapping up. So that was our fourth show right now that was in rehearsal or production or whatever. So as one drops off, another one is getting started. So the Murder Mystery will wrap up this weekend. Sleeping Beauty opens next weekend. There is about a week in there where we're turning things over, and then the Cat in the Hat opens. But meanwhile, on February 8th, we have auditions for Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. So that'll start rehearsals kind of in that gap week between Sleeping Beauty and Cat in the Hat. So as one drops off, another one is auditioning. So there's usually three in rehearsal. Usually have rehearsals from 5:30 to 7 and 7 to 9 or 9:30 p.m. during the week. So we're always rehearsing for two. And then a third one jumps in there as well, and sometimes there's a fourth one if it overlaps.
Sounds almost like a repertory theater with different casts.
Exactly. Yep. There's always something going on, but it seems to work, and we seem to be able to juggle it between our rehearsal spaces and musicals versus non-musicals, small shows at the Oxford, bigger shows at the State Theater. You know, it all kind of jigsaw puzzles together.
Just for the sake of discussion, do you have more than one rehearsal space at the Oxford?
We do, actually. If you count up the various spaces, we can and have had four different things going on at the same time, four different rehearsals. Doesn't happen very often, but I can be working with a cast on stage. The music people can be in the small rehearsal room. There could be a dance rehearsal in the large rehearsal room, and the orchestra could be out in the lobby. So we can have four different rehearsals going on at any given time.
Finally, I noticed there's a little place you can click on for spring classes.
Right, yeah. We've had summer classes for many years, since 1994, actually, and those have been very popular and continue to grow in popularity. And we do get questions, why don't you do classes in the fall or the spring? And we have offered them at various times. Just seemed like time was ripe to do it again for this spring. So there's a series of classes March, April, some over spring break, some on Saturdays, some that are a couple weeks after school, that type of thing. Some of them are similar to our summer classes, and then some of them are brand new. But we're hoping that time frame works for people, maybe in between sports or as soccer and those types of things start up in the spring. People will be interested in getting out and getting on stage as well.
Now, how do you work the classes in amongst all of these rehearsals and productions and all of that?
That's a good thing that we have all those rehearsal spaces. I can be working with the cast or whatever for, say, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing in March, where our outreach coordinator is teaching a class in another space. And, there could be something on the Oxford that the set's already out there, but, it doesn't have to be moved because we can be somewhere else. So the classes and the rehearsals and the performances all kind of juggle around the space, and it seems to all fit together.
Well, he is Wayne Merrick, Executive Director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater and Director of the Children's Theater production of Sleeping Beauty. The show opens next Thursday and runs through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can go online to the Children's Theater webpage at www.ecct.org. Wayne Merrick, thanks so much for being with us. I have the feeling this might be a bit of a breather for you between activities over at the Oxford.
That's right. And hopefully it won't snow, so I have to do any more shoveling.
Right on.
And our weekly thanks to Jim Oliver. We appreciate his involvement in Spectrum West. A bit later, we'll meet Jason Collins, namesake of the Jason Collins Septet. Here's a Spectrum memo. It's an evening of original stories, poems, and essays during a writer's forum, that's the word, Saturday evening at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. That's at 7:30 p.m. At the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center in the Janet Carson Gallery, it's Got Jazz? From the Fiber Arts Coalition. The exhibit will be up through February 27th. The website is eauclairearts.com. Phone number is 832-ARTS. Well, his name is Kent Rader. He loves to stand up in front of an audience and watch people laugh at his stories. He's originally an Okie, now living in Missouri. His comedy is sometimes just a pinch on the border, but you'll never hear a profanity during a performance, and yet, he's still funny. Go figure.
You haven't lived till you wake up in a hotel room like I did this morning, not knowing where you are or why you're there. And pretty much one hotel room looks the same as the last, with the exception of the Shiloh Inn in Klamath Falls, Oregon, which have signs in the room saying, "Do not clean deer in shower." I don't hunt, but I can see the advantages of having a shower to clean a large dead animal. You can hang the carcass by the shower head. You got running water to wash whatever down the drain. But it makes one wonder, how many deer got cleaned before the manager said, "Make me up a mess of signs that say, 'Do not clean deer in shower.'" That'll stop it. I'm skeptical. Because I have six cousins who hunt, two of them who can't read. You know, they're going to see that sign and go, "Hey, Charlie, what does that thing say?" "Well, how in the world would I know? Go get the bungee cords." And the four cousins that I have that hunt and read, I just know they're going to look at it and go, "It says deer. Don't say nothing about this moose."
Kent Rader brings his comedy to Menominee High School in just a couple weeks for a Red Cedar Youth Stage fundraiser, and we got to know him the other day on the phone, and we want you to do the same. Beginning with the usual first request, "Hey, you're a comedian. Say something funny."
Well, that's the first question you always get. I always tell people I'm a Chippendale dancer, so I don't have to answer that question. But yes, I am. I'm a comedian. Spent 17 years as an accountant, and then decided to change careers, and now I do this for a living.
Let's talk about that transition from accounting to comedy. They say many, if not most, comedians use pain or dysfunction as a source as a source of their material. Did your pain come from accounting?
Probably, yeah. Yes. My wife was very supportive from day one. And years later, I asked her, I said, "You know, it was nice that you were so supportive of this." And she said, "You know, I didn't think you would be alive 10 years from now if you didn't get out of accounting." So, yes, it probably was a huge source of pain.
It's interesting that both you and your wife launched rest of your life careers relatively late, both in the 30s, you near 40. It's true that couples like to reach certain plateaus at the same time whenever they can, but How did that work out? Was that something that was just coincidental, or what?
It really was coincidental. We got married and had young children, and my wife was a stay at home mom. But when the children were about ready to go to school, she wanted to return to college and finish a teaching degree. So probably took her 5 years to do that.
Yeah.
And just about the time she got into teaching, I was really fed up. I'd spent 17 years as an accountant at that point. And I was really just tired of doing it. And I'd gone back into public accounting, home care, which is taking care of patients at home.
Sure.
They were going through a transition from a reimbursement, and people had to learn how to read a financial statement. And so, because I didn't mind being in front of an audience, I ended up teaching over 100 of those classes all over the country, how to do double entry accounting, how to read a financial statement. It was just so dry that I started telling stories. to accentuate the point. And I came home one night. I was just about ready to be made partner in this accounting firm, 39 years old. I told my wife, I said, I don't want to do it. I want to be a speaker. Mm-hmm. And she said, then do it. Then just become a speaker.
Wow.
And so I did. But instead of moving or really disrupting anybody else's life, we stayed in Oklahoma to see if this was going to last or if I was going to be able to do it or whatever the case may be. So really, at that point, she was the stable one with a job. And so it just worked out. It worked out really, really well.
Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about your family.
I do.
I think when the audience leaves, they're going to feel like they know them. I mean, I did after I watched your DVD.
Right. And that's one of the really nice things, because I call Twyla by name. I call my children by name.
Yep.
It's amazing how many people come up to me and talk to me about Twyla as if they've known her for a long time. And most of the time she's not there. You know, they've never met her other than through the act. So, yeah, and it has been, I early on in my career, you know, take my wife, please. I didn't want it to be mean. And so everything I've ever done about anybody, actually, in my family, I always run it past them. Say, you know, is this okay? And my daughter, who is actually a Shakespearean actress at the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company, she's got a great sense of humor, and she understands what will work with an audience. And so I run stuff past her mainly to see if it's funny. One time I had written a bit about her and when she was in high school and ran it past her, and she said, you know, you can do it. It's okay. It's just not funny. And I thought, well, you know, she's just saying that because it's about her. And I did it, and I did it, and I did it, and it just tanked every night. And I finally had to tell her, you're right, it's not funny.
That's the voice of Kent Rader. He's a comedian. He's the Grand Wizard of comedy, by the way. We're going to have him explain that somewhere along the line. He's appearing Friday, February 13th, 7:30 at the High School Auditorium in Menominee, Wisconsin, to benefit the Red Cedar Youth Stage. Comedy is best when the comedian has a certain sense of reality and has gained some wisdom by doing some sometimes unpleasant things or sometimes very, very rewarding things. It appears to me that maybe you have transferred that wisdom and made clean comedy out of it.
I tell you, I think one of the things I really like about what I do, not, I don't know if it's wisdom, but there's some life experience.
And I guess that's what I mean, yeah.
When a kid that's 25 years old is doing stand-up, they don't have a lot of life experience. And when I work in a comedy club and there are younger guys there, you know, they talk about drugs and dating and whatever. They just don't have the life experience that I have. And one of the things I really like is that I can relate to a vast age of audience. I can still do comedy clubs and get great laughs doing the material I do in front of people that are my age. And I think it's because they see an experience there, and they enjoy that. And so it's something different. But yes, I don't know that I have much wisdom, but I certainly have a lot of life experience.
By the way, I want you to know that you are old enough to be able to use the word wisdom. Okay? you can attribute it to yourself now. You're at that.
Well, thank you.
You're at that stage. You'll feel better about yourself when you realize that you really are wise.
Well, thank you. I'll keep that in mind.
I know I do. It happened to me.
But early in my career, I got to work with one of my comedic heroes, a guy named Ron Schock, who just passed away a couple of years ago. And I was so excited to work with Ron. But little did I know, Ron smoked a joint before every show. So first night we're backstage, he looks at me and he goes, hey, you want to go burn a fat one? I don't have a clue of what he's asking. All I could think to say was, sure, they probably deserve it. But a couple of summers ago, we were doing a string of shows through Wisconsin during the summertime. And on Saturday night, Twyla and I didn't get to have supper before we went to the theater. Now, when we got done at the show, it was, you know, we were famished. Now, at midnight, your dining options are pretty much limited to drive-thrus. So we go get a half a dozen tacos, sit in the car eating them. But when we get done, we're still hungry. So we make a second trip through the drive-thru. I'm trying to come up with $2.54 in change, which I've spilled salsa on. So I'm cleaning each coin with a disinfectant wipe before I give it to the little girl. As we pull away, I hear the little taco girl go, those are the two oldest stoners we've ever had through here.
Now, on the DVD that I watched, you are on stage over an hour. I'm interested in what the key is to continuing a routine at that length. Do things come out in a different order on different occasions, or do you simply segue naturally, or what happens?
I tell you, the thing that I probably worked hardest on when I first started actually doing stand-up was the segue, and I'm really happy with the way my stuff flows from one piece to another.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tell stories, I have big hunks of material. I maybe only have six hunks of material, but I probably have 2 hours of material in it. And so my show pretty much flows the same way all the time. But depending on the length of time, I just did a show Saturday night here in Missouri, probably an hour and 45 minutes long. And all I did was just add stories to the individual segments of material. I went back into the comedy clubs in December and was working on a new opening thing, which is now can be 10 minutes long. It's kind of nice to have two different openings, because the opening and the closing are the really important parts. The middle of the act is where you start working on new stuff. But I'm really pleased with it. I would like to branch out and have another segment or two, and I started working on one over the last couple of months, and it's starting to come together, and, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty happy with it.
It's a lot different than ciphering as an accountant, isn't it? Writing,
yeah.
writing comedy, yeah.
You know, I'll spend 2 to 3 hours of every morning writing.
Hmm.
And that's the first thing I do is I write. I write to a certain time of day when I feel I've written out, and then go work out, and then, that's pretty much every day. And I can write on planes, and I can write in hotels. I'm not one of those people that have to have the same setting every day to be able to sit down and write. I can write anywhere. So.
Uh-huh. You brought up your daughter, Maggie, and after watching your routine, I felt so close to her that I went online to find out how she's doing. And you already mentioned that she is with the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company, so she's doing just fine. There was one seeming contradiction in her bio, though, Kent. They used the words Kentucky and Shakespeare in the same title. That to me was like Walmart caviar.
Let me say this about Kentucky. It gets a bad rap. It's a great state. Louisville, Kentucky is a very cultural center. When you see Shakespeare done by people that know how to do it, it makes all the sense in the world.
Getting ready to wrap up a phone call with Kent Rader. He's a comedian bringing the Baby Boomer Comedy Show to Menominee of Friday, February 13th. What's in store for the audience, Kent, when they show up in Menominee?
Well, the Baby Boomer Comedy Show is actually a collaboration of a friend of mine, Jan McGinnis, also works clean, and what they will see is a good, funny stand-up comedy show, over 90 minutes of stand-up. It's interesting because even though we're both baby boomers, we have different perspectives. We have the male and the female perspective. We also have, Jan has never been married, doesn't have any children. You have me, who I've been married 30 years this year and have 2 grown children, and now I'm starting to have grandchildren. So you have those perspectives, but the really interesting thing about this show that I just love is that we are different types of comedians. Jan's the old setup punchline, Rodney Dangerfield, or even Joan Rivers, you know, setup punchline, and I'm more of a storyteller, and so it's a great show. We have a great time doing it, and we're looking forward to returning to Wisconsin. It's Menominee, right?
Menominee, yes. Kent Rader, it's been fun. Is there a website people can go get a little bit of an hors d'oeuvre before they come see?
They can. Please go to the babyboomercomedyshow.com, and you can see video of us, get a taste of what we do, and please come out because we'll have a great time.
Kent Rader is his name, R-A-D-E-R. Friday, February 13th, Menominee High School. The website to get tickets is recysplayers.com. You can click on the Baby Boomer Comedy Show. You can buy tickets right there. I'm guessing tickets will also be available at the door. Spectrum West, final show for January of 2015. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Menominee Street Dental of Eau Claire, with information online at msdsmile.com. New patients are welcome at Menominee Street Dental. The most important smile to us is yours. America's Got Talent finalist Cirque Zuma Zuma performs next Thursday, February 5th at Zorn Arena on the UW Eau Claire campus. Another Spectrum memo for you. In February, the Artsy Gallery in Amory, it's a photography show featuring guest artist Marilyn Rao, as well as the introduction of three emerging artists, John Tomar, Pat Murray, and Mary Beth Teppin. Details online at artzgallery.org. The Jason Collins Septet is seven gifted musicians who play all the gigs they can simply because they love music. One such event is coming Friday, February 13th at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The group originator, Jay Collins, is a good example of dedication to a talent. He has a full-time, full-life teaching language arts to middle schoolers in Menominee, but still makes time to write, rehearse, and perform the music he loves, a devotion that began as a music modification.
Oh, I love for what I do. I started playing the saxophone in sixth grade, you know, like everybody else, and kind of played through. When I was in high school, I decided I wanted to take guitar lessons because my youth pastor played guitar. So he took me for a little while, and then he sent me off to somebody else to take lessons from. Mm. And the first day of lessons, that guy said, you need to go buy a Spyro Gyra tape and a Blues Brothers tape, The soundtrack to Blues Brothers. So I bought them, you know, so I could hear a good guitar playing. And I immediately heard the alto saxophone on those tapes, and I put down the guitar in the lessons and started picking up saxophone lessons. So I was just like, I never heard the saxophone before that way. And I was like, that's what I like. That's what I want. And it just clicked.
Really?
And it just took off, yeah. I was about 16 years old.
And where did you go to high school?
I was living in Houston, Texas at the time. Found a teacher, went to my band director, found out the band actually had a jazz band. I didn't even know they had a jazz band. And I tried to get involved in that and just started studying and listening. And then eventually, you know, you start to hear better saxophonists and different varieties of saxophones. You hear Cannibal Adderley and you eventually hear Charlie Parker, and it never stopped.
Of course, they were pretty accomplished musicians, so you obviously came to the conclusion that you had to study music pretty thoroughly.
Yes. So I started taking lessons and started practicing. And at that exact same time, my family moved up to Seattle in the middle of my junior year of high school, and I was sad and depressed about that move. It was hard leaving, but I found in Seattle right away a bebop musician named Don Lanfear, who has sadly passed away. But he was friends with Charlie Parker. He played as part of the Four Brothers with the Woody Herman Band, and he taught up in Seattle and taught improvisation specifically. And so I would go to him once a week, and he blew my mind. Taught me how to play eighth notes and how to read scales and improvisation from the very beginning, because I really had no clue what I was doing, and he really set me off in a great place.
Tell us about the geographical transition from Seattle to Wisconsin then.
I had a lot in between there, too. I ended up going to college in Chicago. They had a good jazz program, and it was close to the Green Mill, which is a jazz club on Lawrence and Broadway there in Uptown, and my college was a bus ride away. Every Monday night, Ed Peterson played at the Green Mill, so I would sneak in. I had my fake ID, and I would sneak in and play, listen to music there. And then living in Seattle, I knew how beautiful it was. I would work in the summer out at a camp in Seattle. Working at that camp after college, I ended up meeting my now wife, who is from Oregon. And so I spent 10 years living in Oregon, where I discovered really good music there as well. I think that's really where I sort of learned how to play. And with this Mel Brown septet was this group, which kind of gave me my influence to why I have a septet. I want that three-horn sound. Playing with them and then studying with Warren Rand and Renato Caranto, who were the saxophone players for that group, just monster horn players.
I know that Portland's a good music town. Are there other good music towns in Oregon?
That's where I lived. I lived in Portland, so I don't know much other than that. But Portland is a phenomenal music town.
Yeah.
It was so much fun to live there and to hear great music. So I ended up moving to Wisconsin because my wife is an equestrian, loves horses, and we've always talked about it being nice to have our horses in her backyard. And you can't afford to own land in Oregon, or I can't anyway, as a middle school teacher. My wife's family ended up moving to Minneapolis, having never lived there, and my family ended up in Madison, having never lived there.
Wow.
And we thought, well, if you want to have a family and raise a son or a daughter, it'd be nice to be near their grandparents. And so we decided, let's go for it. And so moved out here, and serendipitously found the Chippewa Valley and having no clue about the music that was here and the people that are here and the arts that were here. I'm just thinking it was close to Minneapolis, it was close to Madison, and we found a farm with some land that we could put my wife's horses on.
Well, gee whiz, I'm glad I asked. I just thought it was going to be this quiet little answer.
It was 10 years ago. Just a total blessing. You know, I had no clue about the Eau Claire Jazz Program and about the musicians in the town and the area. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd be having to go to Minneapolis to hear music and play with people, and I haven't had to do that.
Cool.
It's been great.
We're talking with Jason Collins, and his septet is playing at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts on Friday, February 13th at 7:30. High-energy jazz group playing a mix of joyful and eclectic original tunes. The appeal of a music career. The only musicians who really get rich are those who are at the right place at the right time, it seems. Plus, is it frustrating to think about how many good musicians there are? Because, you know, I know what Nashville is like, and I know what New York is like, and of course, you know what Chicago's like. And how many people hit those city limits with high hopes of becoming the next big thing? Is it competitive in that way, or do you simply look at it as, look at how many are on my playground, and I'm just going to have some fun? Of course, you have the teaching aspect of it as well, so that's a nice compliment.
Yeah. I look at it as, look at all the people I get to play with and have fun. I actually teach language arts. I teach 8th grade language arts, so I don't even teach music. So music is a complete side hobby, fun, joy for me. I'm fortunate that I don't have to put food on my table with music. So I see it as a playground. That's a great analogy.
You are a septet, your group, and I'm wondering if the number 7 is a classic configuration for the types of music you play.
Well, I started off as a sextet because I wanted that three horns, and that's what the group can do, the three horns, so I have a lot more harmony, interplay, and I write a lot of music that everybody's playing something different, so there's melodies and harmonies going on, and it's not the harmony, not in terms of just they're playing a third, or somebody's playing the ninth, somebody's playing the seventh, but somebody's playing a different line entirely, and so there's layering going on. So you can do that with more players, so everybody can be playing their own thing, and it all fits together like a puzzle. And I like the septet now. I used to have the sextet, but a couple years ago, talking about the playground, I met Dean Granrose, this monster guitar player who lives about 5 miles from me, because his wife has horses, and they moved out of the country, too. And I wanted him immediately in my group, and so I just added another color and a whole new dimension to the band. So that's why it's a septet now.
Several genres of music that you play, connecting groove, bop, modal, Afro, Cuban, ballad, and swing. I mean, you have a little bit of all that?
I think what I play depends more upon who I'm playing with and the numbers I can get.
Okay.
So this is my favorite group by far to play with, the group of 7. And so when I write, I think about the audience in terms of variety. I don't want to hear the same style all night long, to give them a different feel and flavor. Mm-hmm. So that's why I write that way, too. Okay. And I think about how I listen. I don't listen, you know, I love Charlie Parker and Cannonball Adderley, but I'm going to listen to lots of different people as well, McGulls and on, and others of different ideas, just to keep the balance and keep the creativity flowing.
You write a lot of the original stuff to other members of the band. Are they composers, too?
Everyone in the band does compose, but they have to play my music that night.
Okay, but every once in a while you play their stuff, I'm sure.
And different venues and stuff. I do a lot of trios with Dean, and we'll play a lot of his stuff as well then.
So the gig on the 13th of February at the Mabel Tainter, that's a wonderful venue to play.
Oh, it's my favorite place to play. The sound is so good. No mics are needed. The sound just billows throughout the room. It's great.
Your name is on the band. What kind of responsibility does that carry?
Calling the guys and getting them there for rehearsal and getting them there to the gig.
The quality of the band reflects on the guy's name.
Yeah. A lot of pressure there.
Well, yeah. You're rising to it, it seems. Good for you.
Yeah, I'm practicing a lot. Yes.
So language arts, do you ever mosey into the music department and say, can I just sit in here for a minute?
Yeah, I do. Actually, last night I got to mosey over to Mabel Tainter and play with Bob Baca because the Menominee High School jazz band was playing their concert at the Mabel, and with Bob Baca as the guest artist. And the high school jazz band had 4 saxophones, so they needed one more saxophone to make a 5-horn line. So I played second tenor last night, and it was so much fun because I taught half the kids in the band. You know, I taught them language arts, and then to see him again and to see him in that venue and that that light, it was a really fun night.
Did you have to dress kind of like a high school kid?
No, I just put on the all black.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, although I'll say Dr. Baca did tease me about my goatee.
Sure.
Yeah, nobody else in the band had one.
Okay, Jason Collins, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. It's always good to have you on the program, and keep us on your mailing list because we'd love to have you on.
All right, thank you very much.
The Jason Collins Septet, and I think we should listen to him, don't you? I do. The Jason Collins Septet, Friday, February 13th, 7:30 p.m., Mabel Tainter, Center for the Arts in Menominee.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Sleeping Beauty will run from next Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Winnie the Pooh, a children's theater production of The Falls Players, will run Friday through Sunday at the Lunda Theater in Black River Falls. Goldilocks and the Three Hawaiian Bears will play Friday and Saturday at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. The show will play weekdays for groups through February 20th. The musical Pump Boys and Dinettes plays Friday and Saturday in the Black Box Theater of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And that's about what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Spectrum Memo, got an even keel with winter? Well, here's the way to get one during winter after hours, the sixth year of winter stuff to do. At Boyd Park in Eau Claire, it's Thursdays through February 26th. Ice skating, snowshoeing, snow sculpting, winter cube, a fire pit, music, hot drinks, there's a warming house. Some might be canceled if temperatures get too low or too high, so go online to volume1.org for updates. Book lovers who love food can combine those two activities by entering a creation in the upcoming Clearwater Edible Book Festival at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. It's Saturday, February 21st. Details at the library, by phone, and online at ecpubliclibrary.info. Hey, thank you, Mackenzie Wagner, Deb Brown, Dean Collenbach, and Rich Kramer for covering my You Know What, and thank you for lending your ears to WPR. Next week, a look at this year's Banbury Art Crawl. Madeline Island's a great place for the arts. Tap dancing is still entertaining, and more. I'm Al Ross. Thanks, Jim Oliver, as well, and thank you for being here. See you next week.